Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode until the question-and-answer session of today's conference. At that time, you may press star, then the number one on your phone to ask a question. I would like to inform all parties that today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the conference over to Dr. Kasaraju. Thank you. You may begin.
Thank you. It is my great pleasure to introduce Professor Eric Winfrey from Caltech. He is a professor in computer science, computation, neural systems, and bioengineering. He did his PhD at Caltech under John Offfield. Soon after, he was a postdoc at Princeton, then is a research scientist at MIT. All his years, his research has been at the intersection of the interface of biochemistry and computing. For his PhD, I recall he was simulating cellular automata with DNA molecules. Even now, he's working on molecular programming on similar type of trends. He's a tremendous researcher. He has received many awards. He's a fellow of IAAAS. He has received Feynman Prize for Nanotechnology, the MIT Technology Review First TR100 list, Thule Prize in DNA computing, and many others. He received our NSF Career Award, subsequently PCAS Award. In addition to the regular ones, he's also a MacArthur Fellow, popularly known as the Genius Award. One of the people in his lab also received MacArthur Fellow. His father was a MacArthur Fellow. His PhD professor, John Offfield, is a MacArthur Fellow. Between his undergrad and grad studies, he worked with Steve Wolfram of Mathematica Frame. He's a MacArthur Fellow. So I stopped there. He has lots of MacArthur Fellow associations in the family tree. It's a pleasure to introduce Eric.
Thank you very much, Rao, and thank you for inviting me here to give this lecture. It's an honor. And thank you all for coming, both you who I can see and those who are online who I can't see. So I want to talk about molecular programming, which is a new phrase for an idea that's not quite as new, but still fairly new, which is thinking about chemistry as an information technology, a valid substrate for thinking about what computer science does. And my talk's going to have three parts, roughly. In the first, I'm going to give a high-level overview and motivation for why I'm interested in this, and hopefully you'll get interested in it as well. Secondly, I'll talk about a specific set of examples of the kinds of systems that we can build today, which are quite limited, but nonetheless quite interesting. And in the end, I will either present or rush through some discussion about the kind of software infrastructure that we build to support this new technology. I'd definitely like to take this opportunity to thank NSF for funding this research for quite a few years, despite the fact that it's not at all mainstream. So the motivation for this work is really comes from biology, looking at the world around us and seeing that biology is really something special. Not only is it responsible for our own existences, but just looking at it, it's quite unlike the other matter that we see throughout the world. And one way of understanding that difference is to view it as an information technology. And it's quite good at that. Even in the lowly bacterium pictured here, maybe a one cubic micron cell is able to store a 4 megabit genome. So the information density is incredibly dense. But in addition to storing that information, there's biochemical circuitry that's directing the cell's activities and helping it make decisions about what processes to turn on or off or how to navigate or when to reproduce. There's a manufacturing plant that allows it to synthesize new molecules, be they proteins or other molecular machines or toxins or nutrients. And it's all designed at the atomic level. So the bacteria is an amazing machine that's directed by the information contained in the DNA. But if you go into the macroscopic and look at an organism, say an elephant, that's now a collection of cells, and it grows from a single cell, contains an astronomical number of components, 10 to the 15 cells, all working coherently as an organism. If you estimate the number of machines, molecular machines, or say proteins, macromolecules in the cell, you have 10 to the 27 different macromolecules, each of which is a very complex system performing a very specific task. And so you have behavior that's dictated from the atomic to the macroscopic scale and very well organized to produce intelligent behavior. And so there are deep algorithmic issues in the organization of any biological organism. And so if we look at this as something that chemistry and molecules can do, we can ask, you know, why isn't human technology this advanced? So it bears thinking about molecular systems as a synthetic information technology, an artificial information technology. And to look at some of the potential, it's sometimes fun to examine the difference between, say, these two underwater navigation devices. On the left, a submarine, about the same size as the system on the right, a whale, but quite different in their organization. So they're both controlled by multiple processing units that process information and help control, for example, the navigation, either by CPU or brains. But if you look at the detail with which they're manufactured, depending upon what year you bought your chips, you'll have your sort of thinnest dimension being maybe 22 nanometers. In a living organism, it's really atomic resolution, about 0.3 nanometers for the precision with which it's structured and manufactured. And if you look at the complexity, as we saw before, biology really surpasses anything that we build. The greatest complexity in something like a submarine is actually in the processing units, in the CPUs that are driving it. You look at the number of transistors. It's many orders of magnitude less than the number of components in a biological organism. They're also different in the way they're manufactured, either top-down in a manufacturing plant or bottom-up just by growing from a single cell. So our question really is, how can we engineer molecular systems of comparable sophistication? And the hope is that thinking about how to engineer molecular systems in a systematic way where we really exploit the fact that, or the principle that biology has used, that a device can be specified using genetic material, which dictates how it grows, what kinds of circuits it expresses, and how it behaves. If we can think of that as a programming exercise, then we might call this endeavor molecular programming. So with that introduction, I'd like to draw a little Venn diagram that doesn't have much intersection, just inclusion. This tiny little circle down at the bottom is meant to indicate life on Earth. So this is sort of, if we think about the space of all things that are possible with chemistry, that's the big circle. Biology is a very particular piece of all possible chemistry. And what we're interested in is the middle circle, which is information-based chemistry. Chemistry where information is encoded in a molecule such as DNA or protein or some other heteropolymer that you might synthesize in completely artificial means. But if you look at how information can control chemical processes such as the fabrication of a device or the decision-making made within a chemical process, that's where I think computer science can contribute to molecular engineering. So that's what I call molecular programming. So we can now look at sort of the sets of information technologies that we are familiar with. There's computers that we're quite familiar with. There's biology, which we've talked about. And now there's chemistry, which I'm asking you to view not as just a mixture of chemicals that sort of uniform mix, but actually a potential information-based circuitry. And so inside computers, you have CPUs. Inside biology, you have what's known as the central dogma, that the information in DNA gets self-replicated but also gets transformed into RNA. The RNA codes for proteins. The proteins manufacture and carry out many of the processes in the cell. So that's sort of the core information technology inside biology. And you can ask, if you have a test tube of non-biological substances, can you have an information processing core there also? So here I'm just showing that as, in an abstract sense, chemical reactions of some sort, but thinking of them as potentially programmable that would control other kinds of chemical processes. So the relations between these information technologies are manifold. Some of the familiar ones are things like computational chemistry, where you use a computer to understand a chemical system, or computational biology, where you use a computer in a traditional sense to understand what biology is doing. But there are also other arcs, like synthetic biology, where you think about a cell as a programmable system, and you do genetic engineering to change the program that runs the cell. So now the information processing is actually going on inside the biology, but using ideas of computer science for thinking about how to build the circuits. And so molecular programming, I think of as this other arc of doing that same kind of thing in chemistry, where you use the ideas of computer science to build interesting chemical systems that you might never have envisioned building except because of one's interested in information processing. And there are, of course, links between these areas. Something that you design in a test tube might well be compatible with living organisms. Something that you designed with molecular programming, you can now put into a cell and have it control some cellular functions or maybe interact with the cell on the outside. So the emphasis here is not that biology does computation that computers can't do, or that chemistry does computation that computers can't do, but rather that computation, that programmable system, is actually embedded in the chemistry or in the biology. So the metaphor I like to draw is looking at the impact that computer science has had in the past decades, being that we have this ability to design circuits in very systematic ways, physically instantiate them in chips, and now those can either be used for data processing or running simulations, but more commonly they're embedded in your cell phone, in your toaster oven, in your automobile engine. They're embedded in the world to automate processes in the real world, and this has had an enormous impact on industry and what kinds of machines we can build. And so if you look at chemistry and biological systems, we don't have the same sort of pipeline available of being able to design some kind of circuitry instantiated in real hardware or software or wetware and actually put it into a chemical system to control what the chemistry is doing. Although that's really what biology does. So what we'd like to envision is a situation where you could write down a set of reactions that explain what kind of system you want to build. Maybe this is a feedback loop. Maybe it's a memory. maybe it's a decision-making tree that is then instantiated by the design of a set of molecules that carry out that program, and then it's embedded into some kind of process, maybe a hierarchical assembly process, like how muscles are hierarchically fabricated in biology, but maybe for some non-biological substance that you need to assemble in a certain way, and you need to ask chemistry's help to make decisions about when to build different components and when to surround them by other components. Or maybe these circuits are embedded in a diagnostic device that interacts with and directly screens chemicals in an environment, maybe at a wound site, to determine what's there and what other kinds of chemicals should be released in response based on its diagnosis. Or perhaps we're just talking about some kind of embedded control over chemical synthesis so that by having programmable control over when molecules interact with each other and how they're locally positioned, you can synthesize molecules that wouldn't be synthesizable otherwise. So what we're really thinking about here is embedded computation in chemical and biological systems. That's maybe our goal. So in doing so, we're looking at biology and seeing what biology can do, and we're going to try to figure out how to engineer that from scratch. So it's useful to keep this metaphor, again, of other kinds of examples where in human history we've done that, where we've looked at some natural technology like birds that fly, and some artificial technology has been developed to try to solve the same problem, flying through the sky. And what we observe in this instance is that the artificial technology looks nothing like the original natural technology. Airplanes don't fly the same way that birds do, and that's not surprising. And this is partly my answer to people who say, if biology is amazing, let's just go and focus on engineering biology to get it to do something different. Well, actually, there's another avenue that might be very fruitful, might be more fruitful, of designing engineering materials from the bottom up, but inspired by what biology does. So if we take that, you know, here's another example of a dog and a robot. In the electromechanical world, in order to reproduce the kinds of functions, the ability to, say, carry materials through a forest and deliver them to a target, we build something that looks not at all like the biology, except insofar as it has four legs, but it's made of metal and silicon, and has a number of components that we know how to engineer. But the key thing in getting that engineered system to work is having a microprocessor that tells it how to respond to various sensors and how to make decisions and actuate it to walk and follow and perform its tasks. So if we ask about the molecular analog, the inspiration might be something more like a cell. And the question is really the crowning achievement of a field like this would be to build a robot of the scale of a cell with components that are molecular and that's capable of carrying out the same kinds of tasks that a cell can carry out. Right now, we're in a situation maybe that's closer to the scale of a simple virus, of our ability to design a large macromolecule that can carry out certain tasks, maybe with therapeutic benefit. But key to making this these kinds of devices more powerful would be to have some kind of control so that they can make decisions by themselves. So from a computer scientist point of view, what ultimately I want is to understand how to build molecular systems or systems built out of molecules from the ground up from the point of view of having a programming language that allows me to specify what it is I want to build in a very concrete way that allows me to use a systematic task for compiling that programming language into a set of molecules that actually goes and does it. So can we build a fly? Right now, no, not at all. But it's sometimes useful to think about the different kinds of features that such a programming language would have to have. It would have to have fault tolerance and adaptation built in. It would have to incorporate geometry and mechanical effects and chemical effects. So that's a long ways off. But now in the second part of my talk, I'm going to give an example of a very simplified domain that you might think of sort of a toy domain where we can start conceptually and experimentally investigating these kinds of issues of how you can program molecules. So this domain is nucleic acid nanotechnology, and it's interesting because nucleic acids can be synthesized. So if there's any sequence of DNA that you want, you can make it, and it's information-based. The only thing that distinguishes two different DNA molecules is the information they contain, what's their sequence. And in that sense, it's very programmable. And as you'll see, the behavior of DNA molecules completely outside the context of biology, just purely as chemicals, are quite algorithmic. And therefore, you can design them to perform tasks such as computation and construction. DNA nanotechnology is the mind child of a chemist, Ned Seaman, who actually, in a somewhat flight of fancy inspired by one of Etcher's paintings at the pub, came up with the idea of using DNA to perform tasks and to make structures, such as periodic crystals, that were completely unnatural to their biological context. And the basic insight he had was that DNA molecules are a very nice substance that you can sort of borrow from nature, but now start using in a completely artificial way. So for there's a long tradition of this. I'm here at a lectern that's made of wood, and that's not at all what trees had in mind when they were making the wood in the first place. And so we know how to use wood to make things that are completely unlike trees, boats, houses, what have you. In a similar line, DNA is an extraordinary chemical material from which we can make things that biology had no inkling of thinking about. So how do you do that? You exploit its Watson-Crick base pairing. A pairs with T, C pairs with G. You can use that to design either single-stranded molecules, which are very floppy, or double-stranded molecules, where if you design two molecules that are Watson-Crick complementary to each other, they will bind to each other and form a double helix. Often we don't need to pay attention to the exact molecular details, just the fact that they have complementary sequences is enough. And in fact, sometimes we can even ignore the fact that they form a double helix and just two lines indicate a DNA molecule. So how do you design a molecule? If you wanted to, for example, make this three-way junction, which isn't particularly common in biology, all you have to do is design the appropriate parts of each molecule and assign them a unique code so that each part of the molecule knows who to pair with. And then if you make those molecules, synthesize them, put them in a test tube, they'll spontaneously form helices where they can, and they'll zip themselves up into the structure. So structurally, this is sort of like a little Lego brick that we can design which Lego bricks stick to which other ones by designing the sequences. I actually got involved in the work when Len Adelman published a paper on DNA computing, inventing that field, and showed that the information stored in DNA can not only dictate the structure, but also can be used to store information that can then be processed. The field has moved away from his original vision of trying to solve combinatorial problems and is now more focused, as I articulated earlier, on understanding how to embed computation within a chemical process. But this was really the first work that combined those ideas. Since Len Adelman and Ned Seaman initially started this work, you can measure the progress of the field by looking at the size of the systems that have been designed, and I'll soon show you a few of those. Early on, The systems, for example, the original four-armed junction contained about 32 nucleotides in about 1982, and by 2010 had moved up to about 20,000 nucleotides that are designed from scratch to build very complex objects that are maybe roughly the size of a ribosome in biology. So on this logarithmic vertical axis, I'm plotting the design complexity in terms of the number of nucleotides of sequence information that were designed. And there were other systems like circuits, self-assembled structures, and even molecular motors. But overall, one sees roughly a doubling of the design complexity every 3 years. And that's continued since I made this a plot a few years ago. Who knows whether it will continue farther, but if it does, in 20 years, we might be designing systems as complex in terms of their information content as a single-celled organism like a bacterium. This is a Moore's Law's analog. In terms of the complexity of the systems that can be designed. And it's not limited by our ability to synthesize the molecules, but rather it's limited by the complexity of the systems, our ability to understand what they're going to do and take advantage of that understanding to actually design systems that work in the lab. So what's the sequences good for? In biology, we see that certain sequences, after being transcribed from the DNA, for example, turn into RNA that fold up into complex molecular machines like the ribosome. And we now have this level of control over DNA nanotechnology where we can design several hundred, let's say 300-400 small molecules of DNA that can come together to create arbitrary shapes. Here a smiley face was created just to show that we can. And this is that smiley face is a collection of some 300 or so molecules of DNA that spontaneously self-assemble into the shape that's needed. And in this area of structural molecular programming, there have been a variety of different approaches from so-called scaffolded. I'm going to use this pointer, DNA nanotechnology, where you have a long strand and a bunch of small ones that fold up into arbitrary two- and three-dimensional shapes on the 100-nanometer scale with roughly 6-nanometer resolution. And this has been an enormously fruitful field that's aided by computer-aided design programs that allow you to design these structures. Without the scaffold strand, just individual molecules folding up has been another approach, a so-called tiling approach. And the complexity of the tiling systems is also interesting. There's relationships to the mathematical theory of tiling where you can carry out, have algorithmic constraints. For example, at the bottom is shown a crystal that, if you recognize it, has a pattern of a binary counter. This is 100 nanometers in size and a few microns long. And the way that the components arrange themselves count mod 2, just showing the level of control that we now have over the fabrication of large molecular structures. So for this first architecture, so-called scaffolded DNA origami, the scaffold is actually a single-stranded molecule. It could be any sequence you want, as long as each part of the DNA is a distinct sequence from another part. So what I'm interested in elaborating on now is not the ability to create structures by self-assembly of DNA molecules, which has been a great advance, but rather to look at the dynamical behaviors that are possible. So we can phrase this in terms of a fundamental scientific question. Given a test tube of DNA molecules, you toss these molecules in a test tube, what kinds of dynamical behaviors are possible? The simplest possible answer that we might come up with is, well, base pairs will find each other, helices will form, and the system will essentially go to completion. There will be an increasing number of base pairs formed, and then you're done. Each part of DNA finds its partner. But you might imagine that it's also possible that you could get some kind of oscillations, maybe only temporarily, or maybe even more complex behaviors are possible in the dynamics after you toss these molecules together. Maybe it could do something complex, like a chaotic system or more than that. And I'm going to argue that, in fact, it's sort of beyond this stage, that the kinds of behaviors that are at least in principle possible are as complex as anything studied in computer science. So the approach I'll tell you about is called DNA strand displacement circuits, or DNA strand displacement cascades, really building on seminal work by Bernie Yerke and Andrew Turberfield, and then later in my lab by pioneers Dave Zhang, Georg Seelig, David Silovechik. And then I'll tell you primarily about some systems built by Lulu Chen when she was a postdoc in my lab. She now is faculty at Caltech and runs her own lab. So here's the basic idea. Suppose this is a molecule, a single-stranded molecule of DNA. So we have a little symbolic color code here where circle is a T, the solid blue circle is an A, the dark circle is a C, and the solid blue dot, which you don't see, is a G. So this is a particular sequence of DNA. And you can ask, how can it interact with a molecule that's partly double-stranded and partly single-stranded? If you were very good, you would notice that the pattern of sequences here and here are very similar. But this part is distinct from anything that you see here. So what's possible is that this molecule can bind right here because it has complementary sequence. Oh, sorry, it binds there where it has complementary sequence and forms a double helix, but now it has the single-stranded region where the sequence is exactly the same on both of these molecules. And that allows some kind of branch migration process that's a very sort of low-energy, easy molecular process that leads to the output of this molecule. So essentially, what we had is some molecule X combining with something that we'll call a gate, and the X got consumed, and a molecule with a related but different sequence, Y, got produced. So this is a very simple kind of gate. But you can start wiring these together in interesting ways. And to examine how they can be wired together, they bump into each other by diffusion. So this sequence is long enough that those two molecules won't spontaneously fall apart. So without this strand, this top strand will never get released into solution by itself, not on the time scale of years. But once it's bound, so they diffuse to bump into each other, they're in solution, they wrap up, and now these molecules are always vibrating a little bit. One base will pop open, another base will pop open, that base will close, nothing will happen unless co-localized is another base that can go into place. So it's a random walk process where one base here pops open, another base there comes in, and that random walk sort of goes backwards and forwards. It doesn't go smoothly in one direction. It's actually going to go back and forth a lot. But this happens on the individual steps on the microscale, microsecond time scale. So that whole process would be milliseconds. The slow part is diffusing around in solution at low concentrations and bumping into each other. So if we want to look at what this basic primitive can do, it's actually quite surprising. But to think about it, thinking about things at the sequence level is very difficult. You get caught up in A's, T's, C's, and G's. If you can make an abstraction, you can start thinking about, well, how can I put these pieces together at a symbolic level? And you can start to understand the behavior. So we developed a simple sort of transistor-like abstraction where every number on this diagram corresponds to a specific molecule. In fact, the number corresponds to its concentration. Here's the input strand. It's a wire. This is the gate molecules. The gate that we saw before is written here. And what this says is that if a molecule of this type arrives, this gate can kick out a molecule along this wire. Currently, there's nothing on this wire. It's just on the gate itself. This is a threshold that just absorbs the input but doesn't produce any output. And this is a so-called catalyst molecule that drives the reaction in the opposite direction. So if one molecule kicks out one input, this will then recycle and kick the input back off again so that you can have a catalytic cycle. So you can have a small amount of input release a large amount of output. Okay, so a single gate, actually, just like this, already gives you a nice input-output function where a small amount of input, if you have a threshold, releases no output, but once you've exceeded that threshold amount, the catalytic cycle releases all the output. So as soon as you get a kind of threshold like this, you think, I can start building digital circuits. So this diagram right here, which corresponds to these molecules that I'm not going to ask you to simulate in your mind, but the system is either an OR gate or an AND gate, depending upon how you adjust the concentrations. Basically, either of these two inputs produce output onto this gate, which, if that amount of input is sufficient to exceed the threshold, then it catalytically releases the full amount of output. So with a small threshold, it's easy to exceed either this input or that input can exceed the threshold, and you get an OR gate. If the threshold is set a little bit higher, then you need both inputs before you can release the output, and you get a nice AND gate. And based on that basic principle, you can now design things like this is a circuit that takes a 4-bit number and computes its 2-bit square root. You can convert it to a dual rail notation that has no NOT gate, which is convenient for us experimentally. So for an input wire, you either put in this molecule or you put in that molecule, but not both. And that can get converted to our molecular implementation of these circular nodes with little red numbers where the concentration dictate whether you had an AND gate or an OR gate in a given location. And each wire basically represents a different species. So this diagram has 130 DNA strands, 74 initial species, and if everything works right, you put those molecules in a test tube, they sit there and do nothing until you put in the relevant inputs for the circuit, and then it computes the square root. So this is just saying chemistry can do this. This takes about 10 hours. We'll see some data here. Yeah, 10 hours. So it's very slow. It was run at low concentrations to reduce leak. But in the past year, we've identified new ways of designing the components that have much less leak, which means that we can run them at higher concentrations. And although we haven't built anything this complex yet, at the higher concentrations, we're getting about roughly a few seconds, 10 to 20 seconds, to have a reaction like this take place. So, again, if you think about the context being embedding a circuit in a chemical system to control chemical reactions, speed might not be the issue. The issue is whether you can directly interface with chemistry and control what chemistry is doing in an embedded way. So you can try out the inputs and the square root works. I'll give you another example that sort of shows how versatile this kind of strand displacement system is. This is a model used in neural network theory. It's one of the oldest models, linear threshold gate. So you think of this unit as a neuron that has weighted inputs from various other neurons that send either a 0 or a 1. And if the weighted inputs exceed a threshold, then you output 1. Otherwise, you output 0. So the function is you just sum over all the inputs of WIXI, add the threshold or subtract the threshold, and if you exceeded zero, you produce one. If you didn't exceed zero, you produce zero. These are nice. You can build all sorts of things from linear threshold units there. In principle, there are certain cases where they're exponentially more compact linear threshold unit circuits compared to AND or NOT circuits. So they're actually a substantial improvement to use the sort of mixed analog digital representation. But one of the canonical examples is Hopfield associative memory, where you have a number of cells that are fully connected to each other. So this cell basically looks at what the other cells are doing and decides what value it should be. This allows an appropriately wired network to have each cell make some decision that does, for example, error correction. So if you provide some partial pattern, in this case it's almost complete, where values for 8 of the 9 cells are computed, but not for cell 7. Cell 7 is looking at all the neighboring values, performing a linear threshold computation, and deciding whether he should be black or white. And so it computes the right value. And so if you store a certain number of memories into the network, which you can fool by setting the weights, you can now memorize some patterns and then do associative recall. So we implemented this, or Lulu Chen implemented this, with a DNA system. It was a 4-bit associative memory. Here are the weights and the thresholds of the circuit she built. And you can think of this as sort of playing some game. You have some information about 4 scientists. You have some questions. You know, did they study neural networks? Were they British? Were they born in the 20th century? Were they a mathematician? For Rosalind Franklin, the answer should be 0110. For Alan Turing, the answer should be 1111. For Claude Shannon, 0011. For Santiago Ramon y Cajal, 1000. And so now you can, after you've stored that, which is how you obtain these weights, you can now ask the network some questions. And given some partial information, it should be able to guess what the other values should be, and thus who it was. So this network gets translated into this abstract diagram for a seesaw network of DNA. Again, each of the red numbers corresponds to a molecule that was synthesized. And in all, we have now here 112 strands of DNA, 72 initial DNA species that are put in the test tube. So here's our test tube with 112 DNA strands, and now we can put in some information. Like we might put in the information that says the scientist I'm thinking of was born in the 20th century, so that's the orange one, the answer to question 3. There's a certain molecule that says the answer to question 3 is 1, but was not a mathematician, so the answer to question 4 is 0, so there's a certain molecule that says answer to question 4 is 0. That corresponds to one of these wires. And those get added into the system, and now the system will process, and certain signals will go on, certain signals will go off. So what you would see is some of those lines go up, some don't. Some of these are the dotted lines. That says the opposite information is true. And so this information, question 1-0, gets completed to the pattern 0-1-1-0, which, as we can see, is the information for Rosalind Franklin. So the only scientist who was born in the 20th century but not a mathematician among these that the network memorized, Rosalind Franklin. So this is actual experimental results from the system. In this case, it's taking 8 hours. And you can ask it similar kinds of questions, British and a mathematician. So that's ?1? And you ask the network, and certain signals go on, performing the associative recall. So a set of molecules can do this. They can have this sort of brain-like behavior by simulating the behavior of a neural network. And I'll skip this other example. Okay, so we were asking, given some molecules, in a test tube, what can it do, what can't it do? This is a fundamental question. We've given some examples. We've shown that some very simple DNA molecules can interact and essentially compute digital circuit functions or compute associative recall according to a neural network. Can it therefore do anything? What can't it do? Can you somehow characterize this? Here's a similar question. Given some silicon, what can it or what can't it do? So if you were back in the caveman era and you were presented with this and asked what can it do, you'd say, well, it's a rock. I can throw it. I can drop it. And that's about it. But in the modern era, you know that if you can carve and dope silicon, you can get it to do a lot of interesting things. You just need to put the right information into it. But even dropping a rock sort of can become interesting. So if you drop appropriately carved object, some of you might have seen these on appropriate kinds of trees. Actually, I'm not sure that you can see that. But that's a little whirly-gig in slow-mo. And as it drops, it's converting potential energy into a kind of dynamic, in this case, an oscillation. And if you can use potential energy to turn it into dynamical behavior, you are just one step or maybe a million steps away from doing some more interesting dynamic behavior. So what I want to argue now is that these DNA systems, although if you just put them in a test tube, they're going to make base pairs, they're going to minimize their energy, they're essentially dropping like a rock on your energy landscape. You can sculpt the energy landscape so that they perform some very interesting things on the way. So, again, our question goes to completion, oscillates, does something interesting. In what language can we sort of phrase this question? So, what do we mean by dynamical behavior? Well, you might say that if this is a chemical system, then it ought to be described in terms of chemistry. So maybe using standard chemical kinetics from 100 years ago, 150 years ago, might be the right language for thinking about how to answer this question. So we can classify different kinds of chemical reaction networks as having different kinds of behaviors. This system stabilizes. This set of three reactions is actually a dynamical oscillator, the predator-prey equations. This here is the Rossler attractor. It's a chaotic network. And so we can now sort of say, well, maybe DNA systems, in terms of the behaviors that they can achieve, is some subset of chemical reactions. We'd like to understand what subset of chemical reactions are they. Or possibly the kinds of behaviors that simple DNA molecules can carry out correspond to all possible chemical systems. That would be nice because chemical reaction networks have been studied for a long time, and there's some very deep mathematics, and they're mathematically equivalent to some other, or almost equivalent to some other systems like Petri nets or vector addition systems, which have some very interesting properties. For example, as Rao knows well, the reachability problem in vector addition systems is very interesting. It's just on that threshold between decidable and undecidable. And that's because of the capability of chemical reaction networks to perform very complex things. You can implement sequential digital logic. You can simulate arbitrary dynamical system behaviors that are expressed as polynomial ordinary differential equations. You can even, with a certain probability of error, simulate arbitrary Turing machines just with chemical reactions. So there's this nice body of literature, but it's easy to poo-poo this body of literature because, well, maybe not every formal chemical reaction network that you can write down actually exists. Maybe there are no molecules that correspond to that kind of behavior that was theoretically so interesting. David Soloveitchik, as a graduate student in my lab, proved that that pessimal situation is not the case. What he established is that there's a way, theoretically, with pen and paper, to compile a chemical reaction network that's sort of an arbitrary program and compile it into a set of DNA molecules that carry out the same behavior. And you can almost do it line by line. For each reaction, one by one, you can convert that reaction into a set of molecules. You put them in the test tube. You take that reaction. You put a different set of molecules in. And systematically, you go through all the reactions, and you fill up your test tube with these molecules that represent these reactions, but they're just sitting there inert, not doing anything. When you want to start the system, you add some molecules that correspond to A's, B's, and C's. In this case, these are the single-stranded species. And now these species, they don't interact with each other. So, for example, A plus C don't just annihilate each other, but A interacts with something over here that binds to it, and once it's been bound, it can then interact with C, and those things capture the A and C and never release them again. That's sort of the effective way of performing annihilation. And if you do that, then you'll get an approximation of the original dynamics out. And that works very well in simulation. But designing systems this complicated down to the nucleic acid level, if you actually want to make it, is a bit of a task. So we've been building a compiler and verification sort of pipeline, a hierarchy of abstractions to try to master the complexity of the design process for these kinds of molecular systems. So you might start at some high level with some machine that you want to implement, digital circuit, Turing machine, finite state machine, what have you. Compile that into a chemical reaction network model using some high-level compiler. Right now, we do that by hand, by brain. Then have a low-level compiler that compiles it into domain-level specification for the kind of molecule you want, but not specifying the actual sequence of the molecules, just sort of how a specification for how those molecules should interact with each other. Then that can be essentially compiled or designed into specific DNA sequences that satisfy the domain-level specification. Those sequences you can synthesize and actually make. And each level of the game, you can have some well-defined semantics. What does a chemical reaction network mean? What dynamics will it have? At the domain level, what are the physical rules for how DNA molecules should interact, when strand displacement should happen, when they should bind, when they should fall apart? And that gives you, again, a semantics for the behavior of the system. And you can also simulate molecules at the sequence level and do experiments. So in all cases, you get some kind of behavior, and you can ask, sometimes theoretically, at each stage of this compilation process, whether your compilation was correct. Can you verify the equivalence between the chemical reaction network that you started with and the domain-level system that you obtained? So we've been developing some software at these different stages of the game, which I will tell you exist, but I think I'm running out of time, so I will not get into the details of how they work. But I'll just say a few words about them. They're based on a physical understanding, a statistical mechanical model of DNA secondary structure, kinetics, and thermodynamics that was initially developed by my colleague at Caltech, Niles Pierce's group. I'll skip the verification question. We developed a kinetic simulator that allows you to sort of simulate the behavior of these systems. I'll skip a few slides on that model. And let's see if we can movie play. This is what the model does. It's a very simplified model. It's a lot faster than a molecular dynamics simulation, but because it's based on empirically measured thermodynamic and kinetic parameters, its accuracy is, let's say, not so bad. It's good enough for design work. And it's hard to see exactly how molecules will behave. You can see that they form base pairs, they break base pairs, but eventually they find, in this case, a Watson-Crick complement that forms a hairpin. But we can use the same kind of process to analyze more complex molecules that were designed to do something specific, and this simulator will tell us, well, was there some sequence properties that actually make them do something else other than what we designed? In that case, go back to the drawing board, design some more molecules, and simulate them. how that analysis goes. So I'm going to finish with one very quick example. This is my most recently graduated graduate student, Niranjan Srinivas, who took this framework, this idea, and asked, okay, can we do it for a specific system, these three reactions? These three reactions are sort of interesting. B plus A goes to 2B. You can think of that as if there's a source of lots of A, B will eat up an A and reproduce itself. So it's an exponential amplification process. Similarly, C can eat B and exponentially amplify itself. And A can eat C and exponentially amplify itself. So you have the cyclical predator-prey type behavior that is actually a very, very simple chemical oscillator. When he conceptually passes his system through this pipeline, he didn't use these software tools because they weren't available at the time. He gets these molecules. So I'm just showing you there are some specific sequences. There's a reasonable number of molecules. And if you toss them in the test tube, what you see is that the fuels are consumed in an oscillatory fashion. And although it doesn't last forever, the actual oscillatory behavior is achieved. So in any of these systems, again, you know, think about the rock that was dropped. As the fuels and the potential energy of the chemical system are getting used up, the system will wind to a halt. And that's exactly what happens. So that's the stage we are in engineering here and in exploring the idea of compilers for molecular systems that are designed from scratch. So we have a large space to explore. So if we come back to this question of, toss some DNA in a test tube, what can it do, what can't it do? We don't know the full answer yet. We do know that very complex structures can be made by self-assembly. We do know that very complex dynamical behavior can be made, but there are a lot of questions about the fundamental limits of what can or can't be done that remain open. And so I think, going beyond just this toy playground of DNA nanotechnology where you can really start to explore some of these questions in a very concrete way right now, ultimately there's a much broader set of chemistry where principles from computer science can be applied to program complex molecular systems. So I'll end with something that sounds a little bit grandiose, but I really believe it's true. And I think in some sense, this is the reason that biology took over the world 4 billion years ago, is that having information and algorithms embedded in materials, in chemistry, is a very powerful thing for controlling the organization of chemistry. You can build all sorts of things from photosynthesis to very, very strong cables to brains. And I think that technologically, human technology has advanced to the point where we're starting to exploit this capability. And so what I say is that chemistry will be the new information technology of the 21st century. I don't mean that it will replace silicon, not at all. Silicon is good at what it does. But it's bringing the concepts of information and algorithms into a new domain, in that sense new, of being able to study chemistry and potentially biology, but in particular completely synthetic chemistry, from the point of view of information and algorithms. And I believe, although this isn't the reason I study it, I do believe it will transform industry, particularly the chemical industry, as our ability to control and embed well-programmed biochemical circuits into other kinds of chemical systems becomes more widespread in the next 50 to 100 years. And that is all I have to say. Thank you very much.
Questions?
Yes.
How extended is this field?
Yeah. So one of the big differences between sort of what the field focuses on now and what Len Adelman did is he was using the DNA largely as just data storage. And then he was going into the lab, adding some enzymes, running it on a gel, performing laboratory procedures that sort of process all those DNA molecules as a data set. What we're doing now is we're getting the molecules to do the processing themselves, right? Once it's in the test tube, the human stands back, and that machinery does everything it wants to. So in that sense, we're getting much closer to the essence of what living systems have been benefiting from, the ability of a chemical system by itself to make decisions, to control processes, and to act autonomously. Right, so I was told I should repeat the questions, which I now remembered. So the question is about the reversibility of systems. How many times can you reuse the molecular components? So in the systems that we have, they really are rock dropping, and at the end, the solution is sort of used up. So you prepare your circuit. If you have a bathtub of circuit and you take a few drops out of it and add some inputs, those drops are used up, and you can't reuse them. You can still take some more of your circuit and do some different computation with it. Biology doesn't have that problem because it has a continual source of energy. Maybe, you know, a bacterium has some sugar solution or something. But, of course, if you don't give the bacterium that sugar solution, it also is like a rock dropping, and it stops processing. So the question is, how can we either provide these systems with a continual supply of energy, which in principle we can do just using exactly the kinds of components we have, or more satisfying would be to have them use some environmental energy source like sugar to build the components it needs. And that's a substantial energy engineering challenge at this time. That's a place where actually borrowing biology and sort of building on top of cells is a huge advantage because cells already do that. But if you're building something from scratch, you have to build the whole sort of engine and metabolism, and that's a challenge. Yes. Yeah, so the question was to outline the verification methodology. So I'll go back to the slides a little bit. I'll just highlight one. So the kind of verification that we understand at this point, and we're newcomers to this area, so there's almost certainly people in the computer science field who study verification of computer systems who probably have a lot of tools at their disposal that we could benefit from. Our framework is that you are trying to implement some kind of laser to work. You're trying to implement some kind of target chemical reaction network. This is what you wanted to design. You then went through, passed that to your compiler, and that designed a set of DNA molecules. Okay, great. Now you have a simplified model of the sort of chemistry or physics of those molecules. And you enumerate all the ways those molecules can interact according to your physics. And that gives you a new chemical reaction network that is a set of reactions that your physics model says should actually take place. And so the question is now, are these equivalent? There's always going to be more reactions than this implementation CRN because it's representing things at a more detailed level. The molecules first interact, they bind, strand displacement takes place, that releases an intermediate, the intermediate interacts with another fuel. And so a single reaction might correspond to 10 reactions in the implementation. And if you did things correctly, then none of those intermediates will interact with each other in bad ways and lead to off-target results. But in the systems that we've designed and we've looked in the literature of strand displacement systems, every now and again people design systems that have a deadlock property or have a leak property where some undesired molecule gets released, just according to the to the physics of their proposed molecules. So the question is, how do you establish the equivalence between these? We've been studying two approaches. Some other people have been studying some others. One is based on a notion of weak by simulation, where you establish a certain kind of correspondence. Basically, each one of these molecules in your implementation gets colored, if you will, with an interpretation as to what it corresponds to here. You establish that sort of seen through those glasses of what colors it is, everything that happens here is valid here, and everything that can happen here is valid there. This gives you some provable properties on the trajectories through the system.
When you design these circuits, you are relying on recombinations. Do you always get the same result, or some spurious reactions happen and the whole process stops?
Right. So the question is sort of how reliable, I think, are the experiments? And I have to say that how repeatable the experiments are varies from graduate student to graduate student. And therefore, I assume that the graduate students who get very repeatable results are actually indicating what's true. So in our experiments, we have sort of bulk amounts, you know, thimblefuls worth of solution. And in that case, you have so many molecules that essentially their behavior is dictated by continuous deterministic equations, and it behaves the same time every time. But we're very interested in systems where you scale down the volumes to tiny scales where actually it now becomes important to count the number of molecules and you get stochastic behaviors. And there's been a lot of theory on that kind of system where a chemical reaction network will do a different thing different times depending upon which reaction happens first. But there have been very few experimental demonstrations for DNA strand displacement cascades that really address that. Yeah, so the question related to the accuracy of the physical models. The physical models are imperfect, I'm repeating for. I think the implied question was, how does this affect your ability to do reliable engineering? So one point is that some of the circuits, in particular the digital circuits that we looked at, are very robust to errors in the physical model. Essentially because they have this digital restoration property. So for certain kinds of circuits, actually, even if we're quite far off with the detailed parameters in our physical model, the engineered circuit works just fine anyways. But for other systems, like the oscillator, the reason that's the most recent result is that that's very sensitive to the kinetic parameters, and we actually had to go back and fix our model a few times in the course of doing that work in order to get to the point where we could get accurate kinetics. But there's a long ways to go on improving the physical models. That's something we're very interested in. Yeah, so there are certain kinds of systems that are going to be very sensitive to the rates and others that are more robust. A theoretical question of ours is, you know, are there certain kinds of design rules that when designing your molecules, if you sort of keep appropriate margins in the design, you'll just make sure you're in the reliable area for design rather than in the area where you're very sensitive to details.
So thank you very much, Eric. From the people offline, do you have any questions? So thank you very much, Eric, for a wonderful talk.